Hi, I'm Annick Bonnet. I produce The Dark North with Paul. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the Montreal Gazette. It's the best way to help us make shows like this. Subscriptions start at just $9.95 a month. Just go to montrealgazette.com/subscribe. Live outside Quebec? Please consider subscribing to the National Post at nationalpost.com/subscribe.
Hi, I'm Paul Cherry, and this is The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal. In today's episode, we're going to conclude our story. We're going to look at where things stand in Montreal's underworld now. When a member of a criminal organization like the Hells Angels or the Mafia dies, curious onlookers often gather outside the church where the funeral is held. There are usually TV cameras and reporters watching as mourners enter and leave the church. Police are there too, checking to see who does and doesn't attend. An absence can mean there was a falling out with the deceased. It is also interesting to see who shows up at a crime funeral and who they show up with. Take the funeral of Gaétan Comeau, for instance. Comeau was a longtime full-patch Hells Angel in the Montreal chapter. He died of natural causes in 2012. His funeral was held in Montreal. Hells Angels came from all over Canada and the United States for the funeral. Among the mourners was Gregory Woolley, the Montreal street gang leader who once served as a bodyguard to the Hells Angels leader Maurice Monboucher, and who started a gang that ran drug trafficking in Montreal's North End. So you could expect Woolley at a Hells Angels funeral in Montreal. But it was who he showed up with that raised eyebrows. There was Loris Cavalieri, a longtime Montreal defense lawyer who was close friends with Vito Rizzuto, the leader of Montreal's mafia. It was a sign things were changing in Montreal's underworld.
The part that's really bothering us as partners, as police forces, is the way these murders are being committed now. We're seeing murders in public places, restaurants, hotel lobbies, where there's potential innocent victims. And there seems that there's no, they've thrown out the rule book out the window.
A gangsterism of what? What are they being charged with?
So let's say,
of what?
Yes.
Of what? What are they? The Hells Angels? What are they? They don't have patches. They're not, you know, like
they
They don't have to be.
They have records.
Well, this is would be like an association in Italy. You can't arrest people for nothing,
for not committing a crime.
The only reason why everything appears to be calm is everybody's got a piece of the pie. But that day it'll stop. Everything comes to an end.
When Vito Rizzuto died in December 2013, Montreal's underworld was in a state of flux. Almost all of the Hells Angels members in Quebec were either in jail or waiting to go on trial in a mega court case related to the murders that were carried out during Quebec's biker war in the 1990s. With almost all of its members behind bars, the Hells had to come up with a plan to keep their business going with so many of their people in jail, or risk losing the drug territories they had controlled and the millions of dollars they were bringing in. They brought in reinforcements from other Canadian provinces. They were able to reopen some chapters, including the powerful Montreal chapter. They picked up their drug smuggling operations where they had left off. The Montreal Mafia was doing some reorganizing of its own, too. Before he died, Vito Rizzuto had come up with a succession plan for his organization. Danielle Renaud covers organized crime for Montreal's digital newspaper, La Presse.
When Vito Rizzuto came back to Montreal, when he became the godfather again in 2013, police often saw him with Stefano Sollicito. He became his right-hand man. And when Vito Rizzuto died in December 2013, Stefano Sollicito became the interim head or the alleged head of the Montreal Mafia with the youngest son of Vito Rizzuto, Leonardo Rizzuto.
For a time, things seemed calm in Montreal's underworld. A bit of a break after a decade of bikers killing each other and mobsters taking each other out as they tried to take control of the mafia. There seemed to be enough business to go around for everyone. But behind the scenes, the police were busy. While the Hells Angels murder cases were winding their way through the legal system, the police had their sights set on the mafia. In the last 5 years, several investigations that began before Vito Rizzuto died came to a close, and police arrested dozens of people in a series of raids. But there were problems with techniques police used in those investigations. After the stunning arrests in 2006 of Vito Rizzuto's father, Niccolo, and the other mafia leaders, with the millions of wiretaps and video footage of them at work, criminals changed the way they communicated. Instead of using telephones to do their business, many people involved in the criminal activity switched to using BlackBerries to text each other, thinking that the police wouldn't be able to monitor them because their messages were encrypted. But they were wrong. Police arrested more than 30 people in 2014 in an investigation called Project Clemenza. The name potentially came from the film The Godfather, which featured a popular character named Peter Clemenza. In the film, Clemenza was the godfather of Don Corleone's oldest son. If you remember well, he's the one who made the famous saying, "Leave the gun, take the cannolis." The RCMP apologized for the choice of name after people in Montreal's Italian community protested that it painted all Italians as criminals. Project Clemenza was significant because police were able to intercept more than a million BlackBerry messages that gang members exchanged. The people arrested faced charges of gangsterism, extortion, trafficking, kidnapping, arson, and assault. The investigation had started in 2011, when Vito Rizzuto was still in a U.S. jail on racketeering charges. Within the Montreal Mafia, different groups of people, or cells, were trying to take over. That infighting led to outbursts of violence. Around that time, the Montreal police began rounding up several gangsters in Montreal based on tips that they were carrying guns. Police uncovered plots by people linked to the Rizzuto organization to smuggle cocaine into Montreal, to firebomb cafes, and run illegal gaming houses. Michel Arquin was a supervisor for the RCMP on Project Clemenza.
So what Clemenza were targeting is which group were taking over and were causing that violence. And those two cells were directly involved. And mainly the cell of Giuseppe De Vito was directly involved into the violence itself in the city of Montreal.
Giuseppe De Vito was a drug smuggler who had led a small group of people within the Montreal Mafia. By 2014, when Project Clemenza wrapped up, DeVito had died in prison of cyanide poisoning. A coroner who investigated his death wasn't able to say whether he had been killed or had killed himself. DeVito was in prison for his role in smuggling drugs through the Montreal airport, as we heard about in the last episode. The RCMP said the text messages showed he had been smuggling drugs, phones, and money into prison. Despite the claims by the RCMP that Clemenza was a blow to organized crime, no one who was arrested in that investigation ended up going on trial, although a few did plead guilty. Here's Crown Prosecutor Sabrina Delefrani on the day that charges against 38 people arrested in Clemenza were stayed.
We made a decision to stay the proceedings against certain people and to continue against others. There are questions, the schools are issues that have been raised concerning, among other things, the techniques that were used by the RCMP in the course of their investigation.
The Crown didn't want to say why exactly the charges were stayed, but defense lawyers believed it was because the RCMP didn't want to reveal how they were able to get into BlackBerry's encrypted messaging system. Not long after the arrests in Project Clemenza, police in Quebec dropped a bombshell. Early on a November morning in 2015, police arrested the people they said were the heads of Montreal's underworld. Lieutenant Benoit Dubé describes the police investigations, which were called Projects Mego and Mastiff.
The target was the union between organized crime. We were talking about the street gang, the Hells Angels, and Italian Mafia. We arrested the Gregory Woolley. He was the head of the street gang, and he was the person that was the link between the Italian Mafia and the Hells Angels. We also arrested Stefano Sollicito and Leonardo Rizzuto. They're the person who took Vito's Rizzuto's place after Mr. Rizzuto died in December 2013. And we also arrest Loris Cavaglia. He's a lawyer. well known in Montreal. He was a main player with the union. His office was used as a shield for all the organized crime decision was made as his office.
Their arrest came after a nearly three-year-long police investigation that involved the Sûreté du Québec, the RCMP, Montreal Police, and the police forces in suburban Laval and Longueuil. The investigation was aimed at keeping the streets of Montreal calm after Vito Rizzuto came home from the U.S. in 2012. That was when police had spotted Gregory Woolley and Loris Cavalieri together in a Ferrari, turning up at the funeral for the Hell's Angel, Gaëta Como.
I can tell you that investigators viewed it as a significant event, among others.
Matthew Ferguson is a Crown prosecutor who was involved in the Project Mego investigation.
That pointed to the existence of an alliance between the various criminal organizations in the Montreal region, including street gangs, the Hells Angels, and again, traditional Italian organized crime.
The police started to pay closer attention to Cavalieri and Woolley, and it turned out they were working closely with the Hells Angels and the Mafia. Cavalieri ran a law office on Montreal's Saint-Laurent Boulevard. He was a criminal defense lawyer and often represented people that police said had ties to organized crime. Leonardo Rizzuto, who is a lawyer, had his offices in Cavalieri's building. Police snuck into Loris Cavalieri's law offices and installed hidden cameras and microphones inside the building. They heard Cavalieri talking to his wife about the importance of Gaëta Como's funeral. In court, a police officer read a transcript of their conversation. The couple is talking about an article in a Montreal newspaper that says the Hells Angels and Montreal Mafia are working together. Cavalieri says, "Yeah, see, that's my doing. Thank you." And all this started when I went to the funeral with Greg. The police listened as gangsters met in the law firm to discuss their illegal activities. It was the latest trick criminals had come up with to try to avoid police monitoring what they were doing. They thought that meeting in the law offices would mean their conversations were protected by lawyer-client privilege and couldn't be used as evidence against them.
It was the Crown's theory that Mr. Cavalieri acted as a mediator between various criminal factions and used his offices or allowed his offices to be used by persons considered to be tied to organized crime as a sort of safe house where they can meet to discuss criminal activities.
The link between the organized crime groups, police said, was Gregory Woolley. In fact, they described him as a cornerstone. What Projects Mego and Mestif revealed was that Gregory Woolley was a significant bridge between the Hells Angels, the Mafia, and some of the biggest street gangs already in place in Montreal. Frequently, he met with members from either group, passing on messages. He was especially influential among street gangs and could tell them to play along and that everyone involved would make money. Another thing that was revealed during Projects Mego and Mestif was that several influential street gang members who didn't want to play along were killed. The investigation also showed that the Hells Angels had a complete control over drug trafficking in Montreal.
The easiest way to break it down is that if you want to sell cocaine or sell drugs in a specific area that is controlled by a criminal organization, you have to pay them the right to operate on their territory.
A police informant told investigators that money from drugs was going to Maurice Mambouchet and Paul Fontaine, two Hells Angels we talked about in an earlier episode. Despite being behind bars for the deaths of prison guards, both men were being paid a form of tribute by drug dealers in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve, an area the Hells Angels fought hard for during the Biker War. During their investigation, police also uncovered a plot to kill Reynald Desjardins, the former Rizzuto loyalist who had tried to seize control of the Montreal Mafia while Vito Rizzuto was in jail. Desjardins himself was still in jail for his part in the plot to kill Salvatore Montagna, the New Yorker who was trying to take control of the Mafia here. The idea of killing Desjardins came from Mambouchet in jail. Boucher told his daughter, Alexandra Mangeau, who was visiting him in jail, that he could have Desjardins killed in prison if he were to be transferred there. Boucher's daughter took that information to Gregory Woolley, who somehow okayed the hit. Here's Lieutenant Benoit Dubé of the Sûreté du Québec again.
They wanted to eliminate Rénal Desjardins. They wanted to control the territory, so they didn't want any adversary. Gregory Woolley and Maurice Mohamed Boucher has a long history between each other. So Maurice Boucher was using Alexandre Mongeau to give the message, and Mr. Woolley would execute the message.
Police laid a number of charges, including cocaine trafficking, conspiracy to commit cocaine trafficking, conspiracy to commit murder, and gangsterism. A gangsterism charge can be very serious because it can easily double an offender's sentence, and it can easily require that they spend at least half of their sentence behind bars before they are eligible for parole. The gangsterism charge spooked some of the people who knew Cavalieri and Rizzuto. In this police wiretap, Vito Rizzuto's wife, Giovanna Camilleri, and Diane Cristofaro, the wife of Cavalieri, talk about it.
A gangsterism of what? What are they being charged with?
So let's say,
of what?
Yes.
Of what? What are they? The Hells Angels? What are they? They don't have patches. They're not, you know, like,
they don't have to be. They have records.
Well, this would be like an association in Italy. You can't arrest people for nothing, for not committing a crime.
Boucher pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit murder and got another 10 years tacked to his existing life sentence. Woolley pleaded guilty to drug trafficking, conspiracy to do the same, and a gangsterism charge. And he received an overall prison term of 8 years. Cavalieri, the defense lawyer, pleaded guilty to a gangsterism charge and so other offenses related to firearms, and he got a 34-month sentence. Rizzuto and Sollicito fought the charges against them. Rizzuto's lawyers argued that he was being unfairly targeted because of his family name. Eventually, a judge ruled that the police had acted illegally when they recorded conversations inside a conference room at Cavalieri's law firm. The recordings violated Rizzuto and Sollicito's constitutional rights because Rizzuto worked there as a lawyer and Sollicito was a client of another attorney. As for Woolley, the conversations were actually admissible because he wasn't a client of the law firm. Most of the Crown's evidence against the two men came from a conversation that was intercepted in a meeting room and the reception area of the law office. Rizzuto and Sollicito were acquitted.
The net that the investigators cast was too wide, and that they should have taken a more surgical approach. Ultimately, the trial judge ruled that the communications intercepted at the reception area and in a room serving as a sort of conference room, sort of a multi-purpose. Sometimes it was a conference room. Sometimes it was a room where clients, where other lawyers in the firm met their clients. The conversations in both those places were ruled inadmissible. Against Mr. Sollicito and Mr. Rizzuto.
Rizzuto faced two more charges related to a gun and cocaine that was found at his home in Laval on the day he was arrested back in 2015. Last year, those charges were also dropped because a second judge ruled his rights had been violated in the Project Mego investigation. Rizzuto and Sollicito weren't the only people with ties to Montreal's underworld who had their legal rights violated in the past few years.
If you've been enjoying The Dark North, we think you should subscribe to She's Gone. It's a new podcast from the Saskatoon Star Phoenix and Post Media. It tells the heartbreaking stories of four women who died violently. Here is the trailer.
I mean, this was my daughter. This was my only daughter. My only daughter. My daughter. And he just threw her away like garbage.
Some of the most chilling and devastating court cases in Saskatchewan over the last decade have involved female victims of homicide.
Karina was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. And this person was out with intention to hurt somebody.
We often hear about their stories in the early stages of an investigation, when they are shrouded in mystery, and then not until years later when they unravel in a courtroom.
He talked about the murder of Ms. King with the same tone of voice that he would talk about going hunting in that same area.
But what happens when we examine these stories from crime to court case? Would we see a larger issue at hand? And would it cause us to remember these women maybe in a different way?
Obviously, I feel bad for Brittany's family, but I also feel bad for Antoine and her family.
This is a reflection on four women's lives, deaths, and the criminal cases that followed, in hopes they will never be forgotten.
I knew the area, so I just felt that I had to go out and help if I could, some way or another.
Something went very, very, very sour that night.
I ask every client after every major trial, did you do it?
I can't give up. I have to keep going. I have to keep looking for her.
I'm Bree McAdam, criminal justice reporter with the Saskatoon Star Phoenix and host of a new podcast series coming soon called She's Gone. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go back to the Hells Angels. After they were arrested en masse in 2009 in Operation Shark, slightly more than 100 of the bikers pleaded guilty to a general conspiracy to commit murder during the biker war and ended up going to jail. For some of the other bikers, a judge decided to drop the charges against them because it would take so long for them to get a fair trial. We're talking about charges of drug trafficking, conspiracy to do the same, gangsterism, against dozens of people. Way too long to get through the justice system, so 31 people tied to the Hells Angels were released from jail. But five Hells Angels decided to go to trial and fight the first-degree murder charges that were filed against them. The case against them rested on the testimony of a police informant named Sylvain Boulanger. Boulanger was a longtime member of the Hells Angels when the police approached him during Operation Shark and somehow convinced him to turn against the gang. Nellie Benoit was part of an all-female team of defense lawyers who represented the five Hells Angels.
He did become an official informant. He signed a contract. He was paid $3 million plus dollars to tell his stories to the police. He was actually the key witness for the whole Shark operation. He gave some details about past events. If you believed them all, then the case was pretty strong for the Crown. But if you looked deeper into what he said and compared it to other parts of the evidence, then you understood that maybe he wasn't telling the whole truth, and maybe some parts of what he was saying was actually false or made up, or he was mistaken.
Boulanger told police that almost all five of the Hells Angels who were on trial for murder had played a role in the death of a man named Sylvain Reed. Sylvain Reed was tied to the Rock Machine, and he had just been released from prison during the biker war. Boulanger claimed that four of the five men on trial had taken part in the planning, killing, and aftermath of Sylvain Reed's murder. To defend their clients, Benoit and the other defense lawyers wanted a copy of a report of an investigation that was done by police in Sherbrooke, a city about 200 kilometers east of Montreal. That investigation, called the Cadbury Investigation, was into the Sherbrooke Hells Angels in general. As part of that investigation, police had taken a statement from another informant who had given police a completely different version of how Sylvain Reed was killed. Benoit and the other lawyers thought what was in that report could help with their defense and discredit Boulanger as a prosecution witness. The Crown prosecutors told a judge that they did not have that report. But 3 years later, a new team of Crown prosecutors was appointed to the case, and they handed over the Cadbury report to the defense team.
So the law says that the prosecution has to, it's not a choice, it's an obligation to disclose every piece of evidence that is pertinent and not privileged. That's an obligation that they have. And manifestly in the Shark trial, that obligation was not understood by the leadership of the Crown Prosecution.
Superior Court Justice James Brunton said the prosecution had adopted a win-at-all-cost attitude, and he called it an abusive process.
He says, Justice Brunton, that you can only presume, because they are silent about this, that they knew that they had the file and that they knowingly decided not to disclose it, and that by doing that, they were choosing to win at all costs, which in Canadian law is not acceptable. I mean, this attacks the fairness of the process of a trial, and that's why he stayed the proceedings, because there was just no excuse that could justify exactly what happened.
The case was thrown out of court. The five Hells Angels were freed. And months later, sentences were reduced for more than 36 Hells Angels who had already pleaded guilty to the general conspiracy to commit murder.
It took a lot of courage for him to stay the proceedings in such a high-profile case. It shows as to how great the Canadian justice legal system is, and that there is a limit to what the police and the Crown can do, and basically that the rule of law has to prevail, right? So, yeah, I'm really grateful for the courage that he had.
It was a humiliating defeat for Quebec's justice system. The Crown Prosecutor's Office launched an investigation into what happened. It ultimately found no one person was responsible, but rather it was caused by a chain of events among different organizations involved in the Shark investigation. The goal of Operation Shark was to shut down the Hells Angels in Quebec, but it may in fact have helped make them stronger, and it helped put them at the top of Montreal's underworld. Here's Daniel Renault.
Il ne restait qu'un fil ténu à un moment donné. C'était les six membres.
It's a bit like when you pull out a bad weed, it grows back even stronger. They were being held together by a thread at one point, just the six full patch members who continued to run the Hells Angels business in Quebec, while almost all the others were in jail at Bordeaux prison. But they all lived together for those 6 years at Bordeaux. They developed stronger ties to each other, they learned about all the evidence the police had against them, all the investigative techniques that were used. There's that saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And that's exactly what happened.
Ce qui ne nous tue pas nous rend plus fort.
When the last of the Hells Angels were released from jail, they started to distance themselves from hands-on criminal activities. They used a network of puppet clubs, made up of wannabe Hells Angels, to carry out crimes. That makes it harder for police to get evidence against the leaders of the organization, a well-known practice in established crime groups like the Mafia. The Hells Angels have now reopened all their chapters in Quebec. They control drug trafficking in Montreal and are the decision makers in Montreal's underworld.
The Hells Angels, and this is the police that say this, whether it's Quebec police or the RCMP, they're the most important criminal organization in Quebec and in Canada. They are the police priority.
Just about a year ago, in a brazen public outing, Hells Angels gathered at the Windsor Ballroom in the heart of downtown Montreal for the wedding of one of their members. Martin Robert is a member of the Montreal chapter of the Hells Angels and was once one of Quebec's most wanted criminals. The bride was Annie Arbic, the daughter of a drug trafficker from Canisataki, who served time for drug trafficking and money laundering. Robert and Arbic arrived at the Windsor in a Cadillac convertible as police and news photographers took photos. Guests, who included other Hells Angels and people tied to the Mafia, arrived in buses, limousines, and SUVs.
I think that it was to send a message. We are the strongest, or we are the most important criminal organization in Montreal. But when we think of weddings within organized crime, we often think of the Mafia. Over the years, the Hells Angels have become more sophisticated. Weddings, funerals, those kind of events have always been very important for the Mafia historically, whether here in Montreal or elsewhere in Canada or the United States or in Italy. So are the Hells Angels, are they feeling like as if they've gotten to that level there? Because Martin Robert's wedding is significant and it happened in downtown Montreal, so you couldn't miss it. It sent a message of visibility, perhaps also a message of arrogance a bit. Martin Robert isn't a rookie. He's probably one of the five most influential members of the Hells Angels.
Montreal's underworld is fractured now, with the Hells calling the shots and smaller criminal organizations working with them. They include street gangs, members of the Montreal Mafia, and even members of Mexican cartels who have recently been seen in Montreal. Montreal's mafia has no clear leader at the moment. Guy Lapointe is a spokesperson for the Sûreté du Québec.
Well, there are things that we know for a fact. We know for a fact that the Italian mafia is in disarray. We know for a fact that since Vito Rizzuto passed away, there's been no clear leader. We know for a fact that the Calabrian and the Sicilians are in a fight, that they take control. Those things we know.
In the past year, two brothers who at different points were touted as leaders among the Montreal Mafia were killed. Last May, Salvatore Scopa was at a family baptism celebration at a Sheraton hotel in Laval. Two men burst into the hotel lobby, sending guests diving for cover under tables. They shot Salvatore Scopa and then fled. Shortly after Scopa was killed, in a case police said was tied to organized crime, a man was shot and killed in a restaurant full of people at a shopping complex in Montreal's South Shore. And then, in October, Salvatore Scopa's brother, Andrea, was killed. He was shot in the face as he walked across the parking lot at his favorite gym in Montreal's West Island. Here's Guy Lapointe.
The part that's really bothering us as partners, as police forces, is the way these murders are being committed now. We're seeing murders in public places, restaurants, hotel lobbies, where there's potential innocent victims, and there seems that they've thrown out the rule book out the window. And that's the part that's the most preoccupying. I mean, every time somebody's killing somebody, it's a big problem. But it's a lot worse when it's done in a situation where we can get collateral damages and collateral victims.
The heads of different mafia clans work with the Hells Angels. But the power dynamic has completely changed from when Vito Rizzuto was the boss and his organization ran the show.
The police told me at one point Salvatore Scopa was obliged to pay taxes to the Hells Angels to be able to operate in the north end of Montreal or in certain parts of Laval. That would have been unthinkable at a certain point, and Salvatore Scopa, he was known as someone who was very formidable.
It's a dramatic change from how things were 40 years ago, where we started this podcast. Montreal's gangs have evolved, becoming international players in drug trafficking, political corruption, sports betting, and money laundering. They've changed their criminal organizations, learning from previous police investigations how to better hide what they are doing, using technology to mask their communications, and legitimate businesses to launder the money they make from crime. Earlier in this series, we spoke to Maria Morani, a criminologist who has been studying Montreal street gangs for the past 20 years. She says Montreal's underworld is still in a state of flux.
Donc, comme vous voyez, le milieu criminel...
All the players in the criminal milieu have really evolved over time. Their relationships, the bikers, the mafia, the street gangs. It will be interesting to see the future. Everything is very unstable right now. Everything depends on relationships between different people. There are several big players who are in jail. There are new players who are a bit hot-headed, who want to do things more quickly. They don't listen to the older guys. They find them old-fashioned. You know, they're not in the internet, on social media era. They think they're out of touch. And what will happen next? It will be very interesting to see, especially since there's no mafia godfather at the moment.
The Hells Angels, who were initially dismissed as unruly, unpredictable criminals, have become a sophisticated crime organization that acts like the mafia. The mafia, after years at the top of Montreal's underworld, is still powerful, but has had to share a bigger part of the criminal activities with other groups. Much of the power and influence the mafia had here was tied so closely to Vito Rizzuto himself. If another godfather emerges, could the Montreal mafia get back control of the underworld here? Here's Daniel Renault.
Could there one day be another godfather in Montreal, a new godfather of the Montreal Mafia? I think it's possible. He probably won't be someone who can bring people together as much as Vito Rizzuto did, but it could be a man from within the Montreal Mafia who could reestablish the balance between the Mafia and the Hells Angels, and with who the Hells Angels would have no choice but to negotiate. Because actually, if I'm not mistaken, it's a bit the opposite right now. The leadership in the Montreal Mafia is so weak, or not what it used to be, that the Hells Angels have the power, and the heads of the mafia clans have no choice but to interact with them.
So Some people, like Pietro Poletti, the retired Montreal police officer who for years investigated organized crime here, say there is still more change to come. There's so much money to be made from crime that there will always be people who want a part of it.
I still have contacts on the street. I mean, Montreal is an open city. The only reason why everything appears to be calm is everybody's got a piece of the pie. But that day it'll stop. Everything comes to an end, and you're going to have bloodshed all over.
The Dark North, Gangs of Montreal, is written and produced by Monique Baudin and me, Paul Cherry. Additional production and editing by Carson Jarama. Theme music is by Bryce Hall. Emma Mackay is the Montreal Gazette's digital executive producer, and Lucinda Choden is our editor-in-chief. Special thanks to David Rudin and Renee Brumer. From the Montreal Gazette newsroom, we would also like to thank George Kaligirakis, Enza Micheletti, and Jesse Feit. Thanks also to Bassem Boshra. From Post Media, special thanks to Dave Breckenridge, Aaron Valois, Swati Anand, and Lisa McStay.